the biomedical world actually has missed this. And you see this right from bacteria, right up to humans and everything in between, all cell types.
The ones that did develop this mechanism, or they evolved these kinds of adaptations to various stressors, those are the ones that survived.
Welcome to the Siim Lund podcast. I'm your host Siim Lund. Today, our guest is Dr. Edward Calabrese. He's a toxicologist and a professor at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. Edward is one of the world's leading experts in hormesis, the concept of a dose response to a toxin or stressor that yields a positive adaptation. He's published dozens of papers and articles on the topic and has researched this for decades. In this episode, we're going to talk about the fundamental role of hormesis in longevity, biological resilience, aging, and what to do to become stronger and healthier as an individual. Edward, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
Yes, I'm also very excited to have you because I actually, you know, wanted to do a podcast with you for several years, or at least I've known about your research for several years when I was learning about the concept of hormesis multiple years ago, and then during that process stumbling upon these different studies and papers that were like mostly written by you. So you've been like one of the pioneers in this field of stress adaptation and hormesis. So I'm really excited to have you on the show.
No, thanks very much. I'm glad you got me before I died. Good timing, right? Good timing.
But for the people who aren't aware of the idea behind hormesis, you know, we can start off with what is this concept and why is it like so important overall?
Well, it's a pretty fundamental question. What is hormesis? And I think the audience should know that it's the definition that I give is hormesis by Calabrese. I mean, there are different ways to look at this, and I'll try to explain how people might see the concept of hormesis and how it plays out. And I have a very broad conceptual perspective on it. And I think it relates a lot to how I entered this field of biology. And it really is different than most others who came onto it more recently. And that is that I see hormesis as a biphasic dose response relationship. It's a low dose stimulation and a high dose inhibition. However, it's not just any type of biphasic dose response. As I came to learn, the hormetic stimulation and dose response in general has very specific quantitative features to it. And something that I didn't know when I first started, and I didn't know this for maybe a decade or so as I collected more and more information. And that is that I thought that the low dose stimulation could be, maybe threefold, fivefold, tenfold higher than the comparison control group. And when I set up my first database on this, I allowed for about a 400% increase stimulation, actually. But as I collected thousands and thousands of examples of what I thought were these hormetic biphasic dose responses, I found that in fact that the maximum stimulation was in general quite modest. It really surprised me. It really didn't come anywhere near this fourfold or 400% increase. In fact, it was very uncommon for it to exceed twofold, with the maximum mostly occurring, and this is the maximum mostly occurring, only 30 to 60% greater than the control group. And that's really a very modest increase. Mm. And this has huge, huge implications for all sorts of biological applications. And so I began to take a look at hormesis as simply a biphasic dose response, ultimately having a certain quantitative features. And then the next issue for me was, well, most people were saying, well, is hormesis a beneficial response? Is it always beneficial? And as I looked more into it, I could find, yes, most of the circumstances seem to be positive or beneficial, but I found different circumstances where, at least from a human perspective, that there could be variety of these hormetic-like biphasic dose responses where that stimulation was, you might say, undesirable, could be harmful, that sort of thing. And so in 2002, I wrote this paper called Defining Hormesis with my colleague, Linda Baldwin. And in it, we more or less summarize some of the things that I'm talking about right now. And that is the quantitative features that hormesis could be both positive and negative, depending upon the circumstances. And even during that time period, during the 90s, I'm going to say, there was a big explosion in toxicology dealing with endocrine disruptor chemicals. And these endocrine disruptor chemicals, when you looked at them, many of the studies showed these inverted U biphasic dose responses. And these responses were fit the hormetic dose response paradigm, a dose response paradigm extremely well. And to me, those were examples of hormetic dose responses of an undesirable means. And so I was looking at this very broadly. People in the endocrine world did not like the fact that I described their dose response, one of their common dose responses, as a manifestation of hormesis. And in fact, a number of years ago, there was a meeting that was held in Brussels, and it was really centered around my availability. And so I went out to Brussels, and there was this entire group of endocrine disruptor scientists. I don't know, it looked like about 150, 200. And they gave me the morning, more or less, to tell my hormesis ideas to them. And we discussed, debated, and so forth for the rest of that day, so or nearly so. But it was really trying, as people trying to engage on low dose effects, the shape of the dose response, what does that mean? It really has, we're going to talk about, things that relate to adaptation and health and so forth, extending life and so forth. But I come into this from a very different sort of a perspective, where I see hormesis in a very broad framework, and where you could have a wide variety of things that, and the interesting thing is that the cell or the organism or the organ seems to constrain its capacity to increase its response on some of these integrative endpoints to this 30 to 60%. This is a real mystery that hasn't been clarified, and that is in the course of evolution, and you see this right from bacteria right up to humans and everything in between, all cell types, independent of what induces it. And actually doesn't even make any difference what the mechanism is, that the quantitative features of this dose response are really the same. It's like there was this evolutionary process in which this became highly selected for and maintained over all these years. It's a fundamental aspect of life. It's right from the very beginning.
This episode is brought to you by BondCharge, my favorite company for blue blocking glasses, red light therapy devices, and red light bulbs. These items are essential for keeping your sleep-wakefulness cycles aligned in a world that tries to mess them up. Instead of looking at your phone before bed and letting the blue light disrupt your melatonin production, why not wear blue blockers instead that prevent that from happening? Instead of having your bedroom lit up with bright lights, use the more sleep-friendly alternative by opting for flicker-free red light bulbs that don't disrupt your sleep. BondCharge also has amazing infrared sauna blankets that can give you the same health benefits as the traditional sauna. You also get the unique benefits of infrared light that improves joint and skin health. Head over to bondcharge.com/seamlund and use the code SEAM, S-I-I-M, for a 15% discount.
That's a good overview, and we definitely can talk about the details a bit closer. But basically, to give like a very simple, let's say, description, is that hormesis is this small stressor that the body is like adapts to and ultimately has like a beneficial response, whether that be, you know, it gets stronger, it strengthens its immune system, has like anti-inflammatory effects or some other like positive adaptation in response to the stressor. And evolutionarily, it's, you know, evolutionarily, we were exposed to various like environmental stressors that triggered these adaptations and triggered these hormetic responses, like from the environment, whether that be cold or heat or low oxygen or whatever, these type of stressors. And that's what, you know, is like a important aspect of survival for the organism, to be able to adapt and to be able to, let's say, mount these positive adaptations to these barriers in response to these different kinds of stressors.
I would agree wholeheartedly with what you just said, except my explanation, my definition is actually even broader, and that is that I think you'll see that these hormetic dose responses even when the organism is not stressed. And that is when the organism is even in a growth phase. For example, if you take a look at, let's say, cell proliferation, cell differentiation, crop yields, things of that nature, they almost always follow this hormetic dose response. If you stress the system, it surely will. And in fact, in 2008, when a colleague of mine, Mark Madsen, he wrote a follow-up paper to Baldwin and my paper called, which we said was defining hormesis. Mark wrote a paper that said hormesis defined. And Mark's focus was exactly on how you defined it, which was really taking a look at the adaptive response, how you respond to stress and conforming to the principles of a hormetic dose response. And I think that if you were to take a look at how probably 90% of the scientists who research in this area, how they would view hormesis, it's exactly how you defined it and how Mark said it in his paper. And we said that as well, except we had a broader perspective and looked at not just under stress conditions, but under regular growth and other types of biological conditions. But the unusual and hard to understand thing is that in these conditions, and these are conditions in which you might say they're anabolic, when you could be synthesizing protein, growing, and so forth, or catabolic, which is more defensive. You see the same type of inverted U type of hormetic dose response taking place. It's very, very general, very common, and the interesting thing is that the biomedical world actually has missed this in the last century and even into today's century. It's when I take a look at, when I do papers, and I've done a lot of papers, for example, on many different topics. One, we did 14 papers on stem cells and hormesis, right? And we did a couple on wound healing, even the ones on dietary supplements and so forth. When you look at and discover hormetic dose responses, they may be loaded with hormetic dose responses. Yet the papers that have these, the investigators have no understanding of what hormesis is. The term almost never use it, and kind of like I have to come in there and try to educate people who observe hormesis but don't actually know the concept, the term, or what's going on in other fields. And this is a real problem within the scientific community that, for example, the field of aging embraced hormesis 25 years ago. The term, the concept, everything, and their language is very much loaded, saturated with the hormesis concepts, terminology, and everything else. But you look at other biological disciplines that also observe these biphasic dose responses. They never read the aging literature, the biogerontology literature. They have no idea that the inverted U-shaped dose response that they see is an example of hormesis. It tells me that these different subdivisions of biology never know what the other subdivisions are doing, and there's very little communication between them. And that's one of the major challenges that I face. And in fact, every paper just about now, the last 2 years, 3 years, I've to try to overcome this, I put about a half a page introduction hormesis overview so that people in wound healing, stem cells and others can at least see, you know, this brief summary of what the concept of hormesis is that they are reporting, but actually not knowing the name and everything else of what they are about. But this has huge educational implications and biological implications, and it really slows down the scientific progress if people don't understand the concept that they're studying and how it relates to other disciplines within biology and biomedicine and affecting the clinical outcomes of different studies.
Yeah, so like hormesis as a phenomenon is, you know, with such broad implications in medicine and longevity and, you know, many other fields as a whole. And it certainly is, yeah, like I think very underlooked in my opinion as well. But we can like take a little step back as well and talk about what are the, you know, the most, let's say, basic examples of hormesis that people you know, experience themselves. Like one of them I can say is like, you know, exercise is like a very good example of hormesis, but many people don't know that it is this kind of a positive stressor.
Well, you know, I'd say that it's kind of strange, but everything that you experience, it's a stress in life. It will ultimately manifest itself within a hormetic context, whether it is in exercise or whether it's in psychological stress. You know, you have what we're doing right now. I mean, your brain is working pretty hard, and my brain's working pretty hard, and we're stressing ourselves. We might not see it as such, but yeah, that would actually be another example of a hormetic type of dose response. When you many people do intermittent fasting, or they have caloric restriction built into a lifestyle, and that actually involves a certain level of biological stress to different systems, and whether you're reducing certain nutrient intakes that the cell then perceives and then institutes various biological adaptations, changes to that's another example of hormesis in daily life, put it that way. I'd say many people take various types of dietary supplements. I take my fair share of dietary supplements, and many of these they provide an oxidant stress to my cells, and that oxidant stress will ultimately upregulate some adaptive mechanisms that I hope will be translated into positive biological effects, you know, for me. Other things, for example, this is, most people wouldn't recognize this, but I've looked at many different pharmaceuticals that are out on the market that have been approved. And these are, you know, things like anxiolytic drugs or anti-seizure drugs, osteoporosis drugs, drugs that can grow hair, things of that nature. You go and you look at the preclinical studies, and those are the studies that are with the animal models that provide the basis for how they would ever test them in a human. And when you go back and you look at the animal studies, they use multiple doses and they try to figure out the optimal dose, does it work, and so forth. And in almost every case, what you find is an inverted U-shaped hormetic dose response that conforms to the quantitative features of the hormetic dose response. You know, for example, I also looked at about 200 or so agents that can improve memory in rodent models. Okay, you go and you look at these dose responses. I mean, they follow perfectly within a hormetic dose response. It's actually pretty amazing to me. And then, but when they're ultimately tested within a clinical trial, that the pharmaceutical company, they choose the optimum dose or maybe two doses that they're going to look at. They never get a real dose response. And I'm not sure they know what they're selling to the public is a hormetically acting agent. But yes, and it is. And the interesting thing with hormesis, the way I'm looking at it, and if you only can increase the maximum by 30 to 60%, then you might say, what does that mean? Well, it means that you have a very limited upregulation quantification that you have, whether that's how much can you improve memory, how much can you improve lifespan, how much can you how much hair can you grow, all these sorts of things. They're actually going to be determined actually by the concept of hormesis. Hormesis rules our life in many ways, and hormesis will determine the extent to which we can enhance our healthy lifespan and enhance our longevity as well. How much gain do we have in our system?
Yeah, you mentioned the inverse U-shape association. So basically, it's like a bell curve or a mountain, and kind of that in one end, if the stimulation or the dose of the agent or whatever stressor is small, then it doesn't have this positive effect. If it's too much, then it also is like negative. But yeah, like you said, in the 30 to 60% range, that's where the positive effects come from. So it's like not low, not high, but you know, just enough kind of.
Yeah, you are. Actually, it's the most you at the optimum, you can get about 30 to 60% increase. But my concerns with hormesis are that the way you get your benefit, this 30 to 60% increase, if you take too much beyond that dose that got you that, it'll begin to drop down. It'll begin to decrease. And if you take too much, then you could actually go into a negative zone, actually what I call a modestly toxic zone. And I have to tell you that I'm kind of a crazy exerciser. I do an awful lot of exercise, and I would have to say that, you know, typically I might do an hour and 20 minutes of aerobic exercise a day, something like that. But for a while I was doing far more than that, put it that way, much longer, for a prolonged period of time. And I actually started to develop what I'd call signs of having exercised too much. I developed all kinds of, I'm going to call them the beginnings of adverse effects from excessive exercise. And it's also tied into how old you are. I mean, I when I was younger, I think that it would take much more exercise before I left the positive zone. At my age, I suspect that the maximum that I can take is and duration is even though I do a lot is less than what it was if I was 25 to 45 years of age, you know, something along that line. Everything has to be adjusted to who the individual is and where they are. What is your optimal dose response might not be the same as my optimal dose response. There's a lot of inter-individual variability and so one has to really look at this. And this plays out within the pharmaceutical world, where you say, well, this the supplement world, this supplement of 300 milligrams a day that everybody might take for a particular agent. Well, actually, there's going to be a lot of inter-individual variability depending on our own biochemistry. And so what might be good for one person might not be as good for another, or might be, you know, optimal. I mean, there's a lot of challenges within how to tailor, you know, our lifestyle for, you know, what's the optimal level of exercise for you? It's got to be different than for me. Right. And how do we figure that out? And things of that nature. That's a real challenge for, I'm going to just say, the public health community, which I don't think the public health community has much of an understanding of hormesis at all.
I mean, think that I agree.
Their view of optimizing health is don't smoke, don't drink to excess, modestly exercise. They have no idea that hormesis runs their biology. They have no idea that low doses of stress in many different forms optimize. They have no idea that the maximum benefit that you can get out of something is modest, and that you don't need a lot of money to actually live healthy. You have to have knowledge to live in a healthy way. And that's the value of having, I think, the understanding of these basic biological concepts.
Yeah, it's like, I guess most people just gravitate towards one end or the other in the bell curve. Like, they either are completely sedentary and living an unhealthy lifestyle with none of these positive stressors, or they're like really hard or very hard in like these very go-getters. Like, they're super into these kinds of positive stressors, and they're doing a lot of them and different types of them all the time. So it's like, yeah, like the most optimal results come from in like the moderation and somewhere in the middle. So like, you don't want to be no stress, but you don't want to be under chronic stress and too high amounts of stress either.
Well, it's interesting in terms of how this is evolving. I've seen in the audience should know that back in the 1980s, when I kind of reacquiring my interest in the concept of hormesis, there's a big data base out there called the Web of Science that I tend to use a lot. And in that database in the 1980s, the entire decade of the 1980s, hormesis was used as a term, cited as a term, in about 10 to 15 times per year total. Last year in the Web of Science database, it was over 20,000. And so the interest in hormesis has grown phenomenally, since my reintroduction to it in the mid-1980s. So it's 40 years, and it's gone from 10 to over 20,000. And even though it's grown a lot, you still have that frustration that I mentioned before, that so many areas in the biological and biomedical era sciences don't appreciate it or don't understand it or don't know it. But nonetheless, I'd have to say that there has been a great growth in the scientific study of hormesis. I used to have problems when I was submitting papers to journals in the 1990s that the editors wouldn't even know what the term was, what it meant. They made it much more difficult to get papers accepted. I'd have to have sometimes four reviewers for my papers instead of like a standard of two or something like that. And I can tell today, the last 15 years or so, maybe last 20 years, there's been a real education at the level of the journal editor, where they seem to understand that this is a fundamental concept. And it's much more now built into the publication system, so that people can actually do something with that knowledge. Go ahead.
Yeah, how did you like discover the concept in the first place?
Well, I was actually 20 years. I was 20 years old when it happened for me, and I was an undergraduate taking a plant physiology class, and we had to do a whole lot of different experiments, some in the lab, some in a greenhouse. And one of our studies the professor made us do was to do a dose response relationship with a plant growth inhibitor, a synthetic inhibitor. And we were working with peppermint plants. And I remember, we had so many different experiments to do. I couldn't even remember how that particular one was going. And this guy comes into our classroom, and I remember he came in November of 1966. Okay. And when I was a junior in third year in college, and he said the effects of this chemical on the peppermint, they're stimulating the plant. And we do this every year, and they're always inhibited. He said, I don't know what's going on with your with your little experiment there, but something is unusual and not right. And so he said, maybe you used the wrong chemical, maybe you mislabeled something. I don't know what's going on. If anybody's interested, come back and see me. The only person in my class who was interested enough to go back was me. And so I went back, and then he forced me to do the experiment over. This time, looking over my shoulder as I made up my solutions and everything, and we concluded, he concluded that I made a dilution error when I made up my original stock solution. And I ended up giving the peppermint plants about tenfold less than they should have got. I put them into a low dose zone. And so he said, wow, so you're now going to have to give your plants the low dose, give them what I wanted, which was the high dose, and we'll see what happens. So when I did that, I got this low dose stimulation and a high dose inhibition. I saw exactly what he thought we would get at the high doses, and I could see again this stimulation. I said, well, I guess we've answered the question. He said, no, he says, now you just have one decent experiment. You're going to have to replicate that and show that you can get that result again and then again. He made me replicate that study about almost a dozen times. And then I said, I'm done. I'm convinced that these plants act in a biphasic way. I didn't even know the term hormesis. They were going up by about 60 or so percent. He said, well, I now agree with you. He said, now what I want you to do is I want you to see if you can avoid applying the chemical to the soil, because the bacteria and other things might be metabolizing it in a certain way. Do the whole study again, but this time do it in hydroponics. Do it in solution. Avoid the soil. And if you can still get the stimulation, then you'll be pretty much certain that it's the chemical itself rather than a metabolite from the bacteria that's present in the soil. And I did that, and I got the same low dose stimulation, high dose inhibition. I only had to replicate that about five or six times for him. And ultimately, we did publish this work without you. As I said, I didn't know the term hormesis, published it in a British plant physiology journal. And I just said it was a low dose stimulation and a high dose inhibition. And that was first started in 1966, 1967. Still have my original notebook, and that's how I got started on it. And then, as it turns out, the guy worked me to death when I was doing this. And I said, I never want to do plant work again. Mm-hmm. So I went to graduate school and became an insect. I went to graduate school to be an insecticide toxicologist, and so. And then it was 1985, so almost 20 years later, I saw that there was this conference out in California going to be on this thing called radiation hormesis. And that's when I first heard the term. So I looked at the brochure they had, and they talked about this biphasic dose response. And they said, you know, we know a high dose of radiation can be harmful, cause cancer, so forth. But we think low dose of radiation may actually reduce cancer risk, extend life, things of that nature. So I said, well, I'm going to call this guy up and talk to him. So I called him up because I said, biology is biology. If I saw a biphasic dose response with plants with respect to dose, then what they're talking about with radiation, maybe this is the same biological process. I don't know. So I called the guy up and I spoke with him, told him my story that I just shared with the audience here. And he invited me to go out to their conference to focus not on radiation, but on chemical examples of this hormesis concept. And so I worked with a few graduate students. We put together a paper, and that actually, so we attended that first conference, got our paper in the proceedings. And then what happened for me was that 2 years, 4 years later, the conference director and one of the co-directors, they had a big paper in Science called Radiation Hormesis Point Counterpoint, and they debated it. And that's actually what got me restarted on this, because I said, well, they still are, they're acting confused, and we have to actually resolve this because this is an important concept. And so from then, 1990 to the present time, I've just been, you know, like gung-ho going crazy, putting a lot of time onto trying to figure out First, if the hormesis concept was real, how general was it? What were its biological features? And then just getting progressively more knowledgeable, you know, and learning. So the last 30 years, 35 years now, I mean, I've really put a lot of time on it. But for me, it really goes back to the mid-1960s, so where I was at undergraduate. And so now I'm 77 years old now. And so I'd have to say that I've at least introduced to that concept 57 years ago. and seen a lot of changes, a lot of great growth, actually. Yeah.
Yeah, that's like really fascinating. And like by now, I think it is a very well recognized concept. Or at least, like, we know that it's real and it's been replicated, you know, in hundreds of different experiments and in different.
Well, you know, it's interesting that you say that, because I had a lot of evidence for it being real and you could reproduce it. And in the late 1990s, I submitted about six papers to the top toxicology journal in the United States. And each of my papers got a decent review, but the editor in chief rejected my papers. So I was concerned. And so what I did was I decided that I would have a big debate with people. And so I ran a conference here at the University of Massachusetts in January of the year 2000, in which I wanted to, because I had a lot of evidence on hormesis by that point, and I felt that I was getting papers rejected in the leading journals that I should be getting published. And so I said, I want to debate these people. And I didn't think that anyone had any harsh feelings towards me. I just thought that this was, they didn't understand what I was doing. So I got the editor-in-chief, he agreed to come out and debate. Then I got a former head of the U.S. National Cancer Institute to come out, and other leading people like that. I brought in about seven of them to debate me. About 250 people showed up, and it was over 3 days. And the first day I was all devoted to me. I spoke for 7 hours on what I had learned about hormesis. The second day, these seven speakers spoke, and then on the third day, we tried to see where we were. And it was interesting that I thought I did a good job at explaining myself, but I got hit with a lot of criticisms. But one of the biggest criticism that I got was that you didn't have a mechanism to explain this. You could have all these studies, and all these studies could be good, and you could replicate them. But the editor told me that unless you had a mechanism, I'm not going to publish your papers in my journal. That's it. I don't care what you say. And so I knew at that point that it was all going to turn on whether you could come up with mechanistic explanations. And I would have to say that was very inspirational and educational for me, because we spent most of our time trying to come up with underlying hormetic mechanisms that could make them comparable to what is known in the world of pharmacology and high-level toxicology. And I would have to tell the audience that actually we have achieved that goal. And that is that a number of years later, I published a paper that had 400 mechanisms of 400 different hormetic dose responses at the level of receptor cell signaling and so forth. And I'd have to say, when you look at all these papers in the last 10 years or so, that all these papers now have very strong mechanistic components. The work on hormesis is comparable to any other level in pharmacology and toxicology with respect to mechanistic understanding. So we've played by the games, the rules that have been established by the field to try to say, yeah, hormesis is real. Hormesis is reproducible. We have mechanistic understandings of it, and these are the mechanisms, and they're reproducible. And so this is the and I think that's why the field has grown. Is it that kind of even though that was what I call tough love with that conference, I got a lot of criticism, right. But I listened to the criticisms. and try to answer these criticisms so that I could grow and this concept could be fairly tested. Mm. And it's passed every test, actually, as it's gone forward.
Yeah. So what's the mechanisms? We don't have to go through the entire 400 of them, but what is a broad picture overview of why does certain stressors have these positive adaptations and benefits? What happens inside the body when you are, let's say, exercising or when you are exposed to some sort of a low-level biphasic toxin or some other agent?
Well, I think that the clearest thing that's emerging today, put it that way, and that is that various kinds of stress can result in modest elevations of what I'd say in your cells of something called reactive oxygen species, what we call ROS, and these are agents that can stress the cell to some. And at too high a doses, they can cause all sorts of toxicities. But they also can act as signaling molecules as well. And these the ROS, what it really does is it activates various pathways without getting into too much detail. But it activates various transcription factors that can then mobilize and mobilize the synthesis of a whole armada of antioxidant enzymes within cells that can be then used to protect cell membranes, organelles like the mitochondria and so forth against damage. And in fact, this is really what is going on with exercise and going on when you have supplements that are fundamentally modest little oxidant stressors, things of that nature. They're pulsating little stresses into your biological systems. These oxidant stresses activate cell signaling that ultimately leads to the synthesis of antioxidant enzymes that ultimately protect cells from damage. And that's what I try to do with my life. And that's why I exercise, why I take certain supplements, things of that nature, is I'm always trying to modestly stress systems so that they can activate various types of, I'm going to say, chemo preventive strategies. And it's interesting. It's very interesting to me because when you look at different pathways and so forth, It doesn't actually make any difference what pathway gets activated, what receptor is used, or things of that nature. The dose response features always come out the same. This is really very interesting. If you take 20 different supplements and you study them separately, and they're all hormetic, and they might even have different mechanisms, the quantitative features of their dose responses are essentially identical. They're all conforming to this quantitative features of this hormetic dose response. This is not really appreciated by many people, but it's what I see in all the work that I do, and I don't really see exceptions to it. This always shocked me in the beginning, and then it's exactly what seems to go on no matter what system that you're working at. And whether it's stem cells or whether it's skin cells for wound healing or whether it's neuroprotective work, a lot of work has been done on let's say female reproduction and the oocyte. And when you try to protect the oocyte, things of that nature, they all respond hormetically. They all show the exact same quantitative features of the dose, and many of the same agents that are effective in one system are effective in the other, and that's because they're acting on really the same mechanisms. They're generating some low level oxidant stress within systems, and the body's detecting that and then upregulating adaptive mechanisms.
Yeah, are those mechanisms conserved across different species through evolution or other like different mechanisms in plants versus humans? I mean like, you know, the broad mechanism, like the upregulation of antioxidant defense or stuff like that.
Yeah, they're present in everything. Actually, every cell, every type of living creature, in our world where people try to study aging and things like that, they studied it on little nematode worms. You know, this C. elegans worm, so far from a human, yet their strategy is so similar, and they and their enzymatic repair and defensive capacities. Their genetic analogs very much match up with ours, almost perfectly, and so to actually have survived in this world, every single living creature is alive today because they developed these defense mechanisms, and then their ancestors pretty much retained them, and it, you would have thought that there would have been. You know, how does this progress over the millions and millions of years? But when you take a look at how bacteria respond to stress, their dose response features, I mean, bacteria, right? And yeast, these sorts of fungi, the quantitative features of their dose responses are really just like our cells, just like our cells. And so whatever the strategy was, it's been found to be very successful, and it's been preserved over these eons of time. And this is interesting because you would think that the world of evolutionary biology would have picked up on the centrality of hormesis, and that's just another discipline in biology that, for the most part, has missed the hormesis concept. And so I'm kind of seeing these different disciplines as playing, they're going to have to play catch up. And we in this area have to actually be the guiding light and the stimulator for getting these other disciplines involved. Because once you start getting the power of their thinking and their technologies, they can move us much further ahead so quickly because they're experts in their own zone. And you want them to start thinking of your ideas. Because your ideas will enhance them, but then when it all synergizes together, be much better for a human understanding.
Yeah, it's, you know, basically in many ways the reason why we are here is because of hormesis. So like, or that our ancestors, not only human ancestors, but you know, single cell organisms, they, the ones that did develop this mechanism, or the ones that did, let's say, evolve these kinds of adaptations to various stressors, those are the ones that survived, and everyone else pretty much didn't survive. So yeah, like it's pretty much kind of the survival of the fittest kind of a quote that gets tossed around in when we're talking about evolution and that kind of thing.
Well,
That's
I have to say that's one of the causes of how we eventually die, and that is that our hormetic mechanisms, my hormetic capacity at this age is far, far less than the capacity, let's say, at your age, and that one has to, that this is a real component for. I'm going to just say for geriatric medicine or medicine in general, and that is, it's so. I mean, done a lot of work with animal model studies and things of that nature, and you can see when you're studying hormetic dose responses in young rodents, and how they respond, and usually quite robustly, when you get them into being what I call elderly rodents, over 2 years of age, things of that nature, their capacity to respond. They're not responding nearly as well as in fact the younger version of themselves. But I've also seen there are so some of these pathways seem to decay with time. But I've also seen, well, in studies where investigators have been able to rejuvenate, you might say, decayed pathways, get them functioning again, and to breathe more life into I'll say the elderly mouse and rat models that we that have been studied. And I've actually seen in China, there was a very significant study, several studies, looking at people who are over 90 years old who had had minor strokes, and they gave them a treatment. There was a hormetic treatment, and as it turns out, those who got the treatment, those who didn't get the treatment, the ones who got the treatment, their risk of getting a subsequent stroke was reduced by 85% compared to those who didn't. I mean, it was actually pretty, and that told me that, yeah, even when you're over 90, you still have this capacity to respond. It's very, very impressive along to me. And also, even some of these fundamental concepts here, there's an aging component, and it just means that people who are older have to work really with a good focus to make sure that they can resist some of these decrements of age to sustain their adaptive capacities. And there are all sorts of things that are happening. For example, in the rodent area, if you have a very obese, let's say young mice or rats, and you have tried to, and they're more or less non-obese counterparts have very strong hormetic capacity. These highly obese younger animals, they lose a lot of hormetic adaptations. However, you have them lose their weight, and then they actually, not only do they benefit from the loss of weight, but they also then, that's tied to developing other adaptive capacities. So there's lifestyle and there's age, and there are a lot of factors that fine tune, and they're all tied together. You know, they're it's interesting. They're all linked together in terms of ultimately helping the body to survive, and live a more healthy life.
Mm. Yeah, like obese people or metabolically sick people do have weaker immune systems. They have other like chronic diseases, as what happens with aging. Like the older you get, the weaker your immune system generally becomes, and your risk of other chronic diseases also goes up. And you can yet tie it together with some of the decline in the antioxidant defense status and just other overall health markers as well. Like the glutathione level, which is the body's master antioxidant, that starts to decline after the age of 45. But if you're following an unhealthy lifestyle, then it probably happens sooner. And if you follow a healthier lifestyle, then you can probably postpone it a bit longer as well.
Well, it's interesting. I think that most people think that they're invincible to disease until you get to an elderly age. But you can see just on the statistics that there are so many things that happen adversely once you pass the age of 60. So many, increase in so many different neurological diseases or cancers or other kinds of things. And there's a, and I think once disease processes start, it's really hard to stop them. They're very powerful, progressive conditions. And what has really led me to think about, and that is that people really at a much younger age need to start to have this hormetic lifestyle, because I think that once you have, let's say, I believe based on all the research that we've looked at and done, that you could take different diseases such as Parkinson's and Alzheimer's and others, and you can probably slow down the onset and the severity if you started at an earlier time period, so that you're actually pushing off this harmful effect because of you're resisting it. But once the disease, if you haven't been practicing that hormetic lifestyle and the disease begins to show itself clinically, then you say, oh, what am I going to do? I just got, told I have early stage Alzheimer's or early stage Parkinson's or something like this. It means it's already pretty far along to be diagnosed clinically. And so putting a hormetic, push at that point, I don't know if it can do much to be helpful. I think it could be really helpful earlier on, in the lifespan to then, reduce the slow down the onset and reduce the severity of it. So these are really public health, challenges and questions that governments and universities and other groups, need to see to ultimately, make people aware that actually when you're over 60, your health is really going to be determined by what you did when you were 30 and 40. It's a long game. And it takes planning and education and just because you think you look in the mirror, oh, I'm young and I'm this and I'm that, I don't have to worry about this until this is when you are this is when the game is going on for protecting yourself for a healthier older age.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's a lifespan, hormetic strategy, and it really, if we really, and there's examples where it really starts. Hormesis starts, it actually starts in the womb when you are, embryo and fetus, and then these, how you're treated and so forth during this early developmental time will impact, so the game begins as soon as you're conceived, and in fact, I have seen in work that we've been doing on oocytes and so forth, it actually begins. Is right after fertilization, actually even begins before fertilization, because it's how you protect the ovum, how it develops, how it resists stresses, and then you can affect how this inner cell mass that'll become the embryo grows and develops, and they all respond to hormetic stimuli. I mean, I've seen hormesis from before the start of life to after the start of life to right near death. And hormesis is embodied in the entire lifespan. And you can impact it. You actually can impact the animal husbandry and other things. You can impact the quality of life by imposing hormetic treatments, you might say, to unfertilized eggs before they get fertilized. That can enhance the quality of life. I mean, it starts. It's a whole cycle. It's a whole cycle, and it's a new way of thinking about biology and health and the environment. And it's all anything that has a dose response, and that's everything, is going to have to deal with this hormesis concept.
Yeah, I'm gonna try to give some sort of a statement to describe it a little bit. You can correct me if I'm wrong or direct it in a better direction. But, since the moment you're conceived, you're dying, or, life is a process of dying or getting closer to the death. And everything in life imposes some form of stress. Everything in our environment imposes some form of a stress in some amounts, whether that be even breathing and just electromagnetic fields or the Earth's magnetic field, whatever, those are imposing some form of stress. And the natural tendencies like entropy, that we are heading towards death and in a state of continuous decline and let's say degradation. And hormesis is this adaptation to these kinds of stressors to keep the organism alive so that it could, in some sense, I guess the main goal is to reproduce the genes and carry on the genes. So hormesis is this small stress to keep the organism alive, to get it through the stress so that it would survive the stress. And in a future scenario where there's less stress, it could reproduce again or continue reproducing. And it's like a signal for the body to stay alive and to not die, or to slow down the process of dying and slow down the process of entropy and in so doing slow down like aging as well.
Well, I think that's that kind of puts it together. I think that and just the for the audience to just really appreciate, and that is, as I kind of emphasized repeatedly, and that is that the strategy that all life seems to have adopted is that this maximum hormetic stimulation is modest, and it's only about 30 to 60%, and there's got to be a reason behind that, and we've thought a lot about what those reasons could be. But that's what all life seems to show. All life shows a hormetic response. It all shows that it's a modest response. That makes it very challenging to prove you have hormesis. Audience should know that, because trying to prove a 30 to 60% increase. That's why my original advisor made me replicate my study so many times, because he wanted to see how do you know it's not just by background variability and chance? How do you know that? Well, you know that by being able to reproduce it, and then ultimately you know that because you have found the mechanism, and if you block the mechanism, you block the protection. All those things have been done, and things of that nature. But yeah, this is central to life, all life on this planet. Farm life, your dogs, your cat, your grandmother and grandfather, and the little embryo that's developing, and everybody in between. This is a central feature of evolutionary biology, and I think that this is hopefully it'll get more known as we go down the road.
Yeah, so you mentioned the 30 to 60% response. So you can expect to gain 30 to 60% of benefits compared to the placebo or the control group, if that makes
That's
sense.
it. That's it. Optimal. See, that's even at optimal. A lot of times, say, if you and I were to, if we have a number of people taking the same treatment, we may find that what's optimal for you, you might get 30 to 60%. I might only get 15%. We're in that kind of hormetic inverted U, but it's really only the optimal. And how do you optimize that response? I mean, that takes a lot of work to do that. Not only almost anybody knows, how to optimize it for an individual. This is really a when I'm exercising, to be honest with you, I'm supposed to be like Mr. Hormesis sort of a guy, right? And my wife says to me, she says, "How do you know what the optimal duration and intensity is for your hormetic response? Is that different than hers? Is it different than somebody else's, and so forth?" And I said, "Well, nobody actually knows that. What do you know what's optimal for you?" And I have to say for myself, because I do so many things, and I take a variety of stuff, what I think are hormetic-based supplements, but I have to make sure that I'm not causing myself toxicity by doing too much. And so a number of times a year, I have my blood tested for, let's say, liver damage or kidney damage. Could I be causing it? Because I'm actually going over the top and doing too many things, right? I'd have to say that I've never shown myself to have entered into, at least from those tests, into the toxicity zone. I know that I have exceeded it on the exercise, because of I had a whole series of overuse and over-exercise symptoms. So I had to cut back on what I was doing, and then those symptoms actually went away. And so I think that understanding that there is a inverted U, that too little isn't right, too much can be harmful. You have to find, that what they call the Goldilocks zone, or this optimal zone. And this is what public health, and this is what medicine really has to strive for. And even there are so many other applications, we haven't even talked about these. For example, many people have surgeries and so forth that can be planned, and different investigators have shown that you can even do, preconditioning to stress yourself before a major stress event, to protect yourself against all the stress you'll have from a surgical endeavor, or it could be, something else. I mean, even when you are going through major radiation treatments, I mean, you could pre-treat yourself prior to the radiation, actually, and you could reduce the degree of, let's say, mutational or rather damage that the high dose of radiation are causing to your body. There are a lot of things that people could do that they don't even, the system doesn't even think about, doesn't allow you to think about, doesn't even, it's not on their radar screen. But to the thinking person who knows this, you can make a difference for yourself, but you'd like to have a difference made for all society, so that these things are built in, and make the system work better, so that people could come out of it more healthy than they went into it. You know, that sort of thing.
Yeah, like I think one form of this preconditioning hormesis that I guess the mainstream medicine might use, or I've heard that they have used, is the use of like some form of intermittent fasting or fasting mimicking diet together with chemotherapy that supposedly reduces like the negative side effects from chemotherapy. And it's another form of this, you know, preconditioning your body before a larger stressor, which then makes the larger stressor smaller or have less of a negative effect.
Be an example. That's a current one that's emerging in the last, few years, you know, that sort of thing. And there's all sorts of examples of preconditioning prior to stress, you know, that sort of thing. But also there were such things as post conditioning. We talk about doing something in advance, but actually you can be, if you were exposed to, let's say you had a stroke or you had a brain traumatic damage or something like that, there are people, there's definitely good research that shows that if you intervene within a certain period of time after the damage, I mean, right after the damage, it's a limited window, but you can enter into it with a hormetic stress that will call it a post-conditioning treatment that can arrive by a different mechanism than the preconditioning, but you can get the same degree of protection. And I've seen that in on the brain, on the heart, and so forth. It's as biologically real as preconditioning and as effective, that sort of thing. These are all part of, I don't know what's going to happen like 100 years from now, 200 years from now, but there's going to be, just a wealth of new possibilities for future generations. I mean, we're in many ways pioneers with an idea and pointing the way. We really are pointing the way, kind of like the Wright brothers with an airplane, that sort of thing. And to see space travel today. So we're kind of the Wright brothers when it comes to biological adaptations. 100 years from now, 200 years from now, I mean, I tell you, I think that things could be, it would just be amazing to see how people build upon and take this information, these concepts, and then apply it. It's very, very, the potential is interesting. I don't know what new technology will do to the 30 to 60% zone, because we're really constrained within a biological context here. Whether CRISPR technology and other things will come in to try to modify these and so forth. But this, with something that's so general built into every single organism, I'm a little bit fearful that if you found a way to increase the hormetic maxima to like threefold or fourfold, what that might be harmful to the overall survival interest of the organism or cell. I mean, these are biological questions, that people will ultimately be testing in the laboratory. I mean, this is like way down the road, but maybe not that far down the road. Where people say, well, I mean, you get 30 to 60%. I can break those restrictions and get you to, I mean, for example, like an Alzheimer's patient, you may be able to take an Alzheimer's patient who can't find his way to the bathroom or put on his shoes. Then you might give a treatment, so now he can find his way to the bathroom and put on his shoes. You might say, well, okay, that's a 20% improvement. Maybe I can do, get them up to, 100%. I can keep improving on this with these, with new approaches and so forth. How things will be in 50 years, 100 years, be very, very interesting. And human creativity is pretty impressive. So I'm hopeful on, that things will be refined much more. And as I said, I think that we're the Wright brothers when it comes to this public health revolution that we're talking about today, because it really is a revolution in thinking.
Mm. Yeah, I agree with that. And we can maybe mention, so we know the basic idea of hormesis. We know that it's like these positive stressors. So you can give maybe some examples that people can utilize in their everyday life to engage in some hormesis. Of course, exercise and some form of dietary restriction that we mentioned already. So you can also mention what you do in terms of your daily routine to, find this low dose stimulation.
It's interesting. I'd have to give the audience kind of a curious thing. I remember, this is probably 20 years ago, I was giving a talk up in Canada on a radio station, and it was on hormesis. And the person said, well, since you spend your whole life doing hormesis, took the question that you just asked, what do you do, to enhance, your life, lifestyle and everything else? And I says, oh gosh, I said, I'm Mr. Hormesis in my work, in my life, I'm like anti-hormesis. When I work out, I work out too much and too hard. Mm-hmm. When I work in my job, I never stop working. I said, my hormesis is like this low dose thing, and my life is like way over the top dosing. And mm-hmm. I said, I'm getting a lot of scientific papers published on hormesis, but it isn't helping my personal life. I said, so how can I change this? And so I would have to say, in the last 10 years or so, or a bit more than that, I developed a intermittent fasting lifestyle, which I've morphed and changed over time. And now I eat one meal a day. I go 23 hours without eating, and then I eat. And so I have and at the same time, about 4 hours before I eat, I will exercise pretty vigorously. And so this afternoon, mid-afternoon, I will go and I'll do about an hour, 15 or so minutes intense on a bicycle. I'll burn probably 800 calories, 900 calories, that sort of thing. And so there's a fairly substantial, for me, that's what I do. And I'd have to say that what I do is I take exercise for me is the best medicine. Okay, I have to say that exercise, I like it because it affects everything. I think from head to toe, to me, it's like the best medicine. And at the same time, what I do is I take a wide range of supplements. I find eating one meal a day a challenge for me. I always used to have a lot of times two meals a day. I had it built into an intermittent fasting, and I was always have five vegetables or five fruits, or there was a certain I love to have fruits and vegetables and eat a lot of them. And I find that when I eat one meal a day, man, I don't want to feel bloated in my stomach. I want to feel comfortable in my stomach. And I really can't have five fruits and all these vegetables and whatever, because I'm not that big to begin with, and my stomach can't be that large, isn't that large to begin with. And I said, how do I maintain this healthy lifestyle with just this one meal a day? And I don't want to feel uncomfortable. And so I said, so there are different ways to do this. But also I actually ingest probably about 40 or 50 supplements a day. I do a mixture between morning and afternoon. I have to say each of these supplements before I take them in, before I ingest them. I actually do a lot of literature search on each one, and to try to find out, you know, a lot of biology, the tissue distribution, where it goes, and you know, how much is crossing the blood-brain barrier, where they all end up going, what their half-life is in the body, and what their effects are. And I actually try to mix and match agents that I want to take with. Some agents will not pass the blood-brain barrier, some will. Now, some agents go to certain organs and others go to other organs. And I have a matrix and I try to put those together. And I try to say, well, what actually will seem to work for me? And so I actually go through this and so I balanced it off between giving half-lives and everything. You know, what I take in the morning, at night, what I take twice a day, and however I do that. I'd say many of the things that I take, I've now published papers on. And so when I really go into these in great detail, these get obviously translated into scientific papers that other people can read. And all these papers, I would have to tell the audience, the scientific community is never satisfactory. It's intriguing. It's encouraging. You see lots of good effects. You see this, and you see a lot of things. And in the end, there's insufficient data on almost everything to make a legitimate, you know, public health decision on this agent versus another to the next to the next. And yet, and you can't wait for the U.S. or other Food and Drug Administration to tell you what to do, because they're never going to tell you what to do. So you see all these studies that are highly suggestive and that could be good, and you say, oh, should I take this or not take this? Who am I going to listen to? And I say to myself, Ed, I said, you know enough to understand these things. Right. You're going to have to decide what you're going to take or not, and then make this decision and so forth. And so, and yet there's a lot of uncertainty in this, because you're always trying to stay on top of this. I tell you, a number of years ago, I sent my listing of supplements that I take. I sent them to about 20 leading neuroscientists across the world. And I said, this is what I take to preserve my neurons and whatever else part of my body. And I said, tell me what you do. And because we've never really published papers on what we take. We always, you know, do the traditional scientific papers. Every one of these neuroscientists wrote me back with what they take to preserve their neurons. It was very interesting. And I'd have to tell you that would be a very interesting paper to publish. I can tell you that. But I'd have to tell you that each of these very high level people, they were all very different from each other. This was like their own personal decision. This one did X and someone did Y and someone did something else. And then I looked at them and I said, well, who's the craziest one of the 20? And I said, well, look in the mirror and see who the craziest one of it is. It's you. I said, I'm much more aggressive than all of them were. You know, they were all doing something, and they're all a little, and I could learn from each, you know, we all could learn from each other. You know, that's and I asked why they were doing certain things and so forth. But yeah, there's a lot of there's a lot that needs to be discussed on this and try to, because I mean, I'd be happy someday to talk with you in the audience about really go over what I take and why I take it. And you know, because that's getting down to where the rubber meets the road. You know, what do you actually do, and why do you actually do it, and what's the justification for you know, why you're taking this? And I'd have to say, my wife and my two educated sons, they look at me and they say, Dad, you're an N of one. And so we'll see what happens to you before we follow your lifestyle, right? And so even in my own little environment of my own, you might say, family, none of them listen to me. You know, the only one who listens to me is me. And I say to myself, you know, I know a lot more than they think I know, because I work 80 hours a week on this stuff, and I've been doing that for decades. I know a lot, you know, I think I do. And but not enough to convince the people that I've lived with to follow what I do. But yeah, and I said, well, they said, well, how does this make you feel? You take all these. I said, I don't feel any, I wouldn't feel any different if I stopped it. I said, what I'm really trying to do is I said, I'm trying to slow down protein oxidation. I'm trying to, you know, these are subtle things that ultimately cripple yourselves. I'm trying to upregulate, you know, processes that process all these damaged organelles and mitochondria and recycle them or get rid of them or however this is going to go on. I said, these are things, it's not like you wake up and say, oh, wow, I'm loaded with energy. This is the long game. And I said, it's all molecular oxidation. And you're trying to find ways to optimize, you know, what should go on in a cell and how to optimize the clearing out of damaged protein and things of that nature. Don't expect to take a pill one day and say, oh, wow, because I see these advertisements on television. I take this and I can walk up the stairs today. And I said, I don't think that's how it works. That's not how it works for me. I said, this is a much deeper biological question. It really deals with, you know, it deals with how cells deals with damage and how it recycles damaged protein and how you don't gum up the metabolic works in your cells. And the next thing you know, you have a more prolonged lifespan that is better functioning than people that don't follow that.
Right. But how do you know if it's too much? Or how do you know if you've exceeded the optimal zone of the hormesis?
Well, that's a great question. The only way that I have done it is that, I mean, one is subjective. You have to understand yourself and how you, and I did that with the exercise, or I had to tone it back. The other is that I do go and I it's not great, but I have. You know, I go in a number of times a year and I have I have certain, you know, blood and urine taken and I have it looked at for certain types of changes. And, and so that's telling me if I've gone too far for the most part. And, so, but most people, I can't imagine almost anybody doing that. And the physicians that you go and talk to, they don't have a clue of what you're talking about either. if you know what I mean, they're very good for a lot of different things, but you know, I find that this is, you have to, if you have a physician who understands you and you can educate the physician to then work with you to help you monitor what you want monitored, then that's, see, yeah, you have to have a cooperating, you know, medical group that you interact with, and they see this as, and I don't mind paying for extra tests or this and that and so forth, you know, because it's in my best interest to do that. But this is not an easy thing to do, because you know, the studies are imperfect. You have to make judgments. See, in your life, you say, okay, I'm 77 years old, right? And let's say I want to take a new supplement. Well, I mean, how many years do I have left? How's it going to make me feel? How do I know that it's going to work? And I'd have to say, all I do is study. And so I study these things. And so I have some sort of a sense. One thing I don't, you know, have, you know, this is interesting. That there, I take a lot of different substances. Some of them have act on similar same mechanisms, but I can tell you, if I take, when you take a look at a very specific chemical tested showing hormesis, then you can take a mixture of chemicals showing hormesis. Mixtures still conform to the same quantitative constraints of hormesis. You might take six hormetic agents, each that show 30 to 60%. Optimal. You mix them all together, you are not going to get anything additive beyond the 30 to 60%. This is what we've shown in our work. And it's so interesting when you take a look at extracts from plants versus specific chemicals, you don't get any difference in the optimal response from mixture to an individual chemical. It's really very, very, you know, Very, very interesting. Why is that the case? And so I, these are, you know, these are things that we have to work out and work with at the present time. But my fear of all this is that we're so far ahead of the governments. We're so far ahead of the medical community. I mean, we are pushing the envelope of applications.
Mm.
And I think that's quite real.
Mm. Yeah. What about these, let's say, evolutionarily novel and let's say unnatural kinds of stressors, like different chemicals in our environment and microplastics and those kind of things? Like, do those also have any hormetic benefit?
Well, I'll have to say that we're published on microplastics, and they actually, and a lot of people have actually, and they do show hormetic effects. If you stress a system, the system responds to that stress by a compensatory process. Mm. And this was actually my original work with the plants and this growth inhibitor. If you really looked at the plant growth over time, you initially cause some limited toxicity. And then what happens is that the plant responds by not only repairing the damage, but then it overcompensates modestly, no more than the 30 to 60%. And it's interesting too, on like the ionizing radiation, which, you know, is a mutagen and this sort of thing, but ionizing radiation from X-rays, things of that nature, when it hits cells, it can cause damage, but it also causes water to be hydrolyzed. It'll form reactive oxygen species. It creates an interesting cellular milieu. But what it does is it ultimately it stimulates the cell to generate a whole armada of antioxidant agents. And in fact, what many people have shown, and that is that low doses of relatively low doses of X-rays, when you know, can be used effectively to treat areas of inflammation, to treat arthritis, to treat all kinds of circumstances. I've seen this in animal studies where I saw a study out of Germany. It had about six or seven different arthritic models, of genetic or dietary or other factors, or chemically induced and so forth. And they treated them all with a wide range dose of X-rays. And these mice had very swollen paws. I mean, very sore, very swollen. When they treated them with the X-rays, this is so strange, at the optimal dose of the X-ray, it just turned on these antioxidant responses, and the swelling in the paws of these mice just went right down to what it would be in the control group. And then at higher doses, it actually caused more oxidant stress, that sort of thing. And so you have nature is very interesting, and nature, you know, our bodies are amazing in how they have evolved to cope with all sorts of stress within a limited range, and even the exposure to highly toxic agents, things like methyl mercury or cadmium or lead or beyond the radiation, you find that they all induce these adaptive mechanisms that the body is trying to protect against them. And right. I wouldn't advocate taking any of these things, but and they're all toxins in their own right. But nonetheless, the body is showing its capacity to protect itself. That's what it's really doing. You know, evolution, and the study of evolution has taught me that humans are, and on all life that we see on Earth, they are survivors. We are survivors of a long process, and we're the, you might say, the current victors, so to speak. And what that means is that we've been through a lot of, you know, fights over the millennia, developed a capacity to protect ourselves, and our capacity to resist damage is very robust. And we're not sissies, or we're not weak as a species. We're very strong as a species. We have all these capacities to protect ourselves. And what we're trying to do in this discussion today is talk about ways in which we can make sure that we can keep them robust to help us live a more healthy lifespan and a longer life that within the constraints of what evolution's imposed on us, which is, I believe, this 30 to 60% constraint. You know, that sort of thing. And so people are afraid of stresses, but they should not be afraid of stress, reasonable stress, because that will actually activate adaptive mechanisms that will make us even more robust. That's how I look at it. And that is, everything I do in life is to stress myself. Everything I do in life is to stress myself.
In moderation.
And that's right. That's right. And ask me other questions. I mean, as a result of literature, I started to do, you know, cold showers and this sort of thing. I do everything not that it's terribly, comforting to take a cold shower at the cold, 3 to 5 minute cold shower every day at the coldest amount of water that comes out of the faucet. But I do that. This is another example of, I know that'll induce cold shock proteins and things of this nature. And I don't know what they're ultimately doing for me. Everything I do is predicated around a stress, a low level stress that I think will have a net benefit, a net benefit. And so that's why we're really, as I said, we're so early in this game of, I mean, we know a lot, we know an awful lot, but we're still early in the application game for humanity. And that's why I think that, 100 years down the road, 200 years down the road, I can't imagine this, what people will see or do with what we know today. Amazing.
With regard to like the mercury and these other like plastics and stuff, I guess the dose for the homeopathic dose is probably like pretty small. So like, the amount of cadmium or some other heavy metal that would not cause a negative response is probably like super small compared to some other like more natural stressor, like, vegetables or coffee or something like that.
Well, I have to say that each depends on the organ, on the agent in the organism. But on the pollution side, I mean, I would always be cautious and say, I'd want doses as low as possible, because I'd prefer to take my stress from dietary supplements, exercise, and other lifestyle adjustments. There is a possibility that toxic substances, could have a beneficial effect. I know that they do. I've seen enough studies to know that they do. That's not how people should be getting their hormetic dose responses. should be getting their hormetic dose responses to via things that are, but everything we do is toxic. These supplements and other things, exercise, everything we do, if it goes beyond the dose, is toxic. But I would have to say that there are some things, the agents that are just inherently more toxic, and some of these, a lot of the supplements I take, they don't really have nutritional value. They just have a value that they upregulate various pathways and within the body, but they're not for nutritional functioning.
Yeah, you're not taking vitamins or
that's sort of thing, right? And but nonetheless, I think that the regulatory groups and so forth, they should really speak about, how do we optimize a healthy lifespan? How do we optimize longevity approaches? What's the strategy for optimization here. And it really is stressing people, stressing them psychologically. Okay, stressing. I don't mean, you know, like putting them through, you know, Marine boot camp. I mean, that's got to be too much. But you don't. You want to have healthy stress. You want to have you want your children to be stressed. You don't want them to be coddled. You want them to you know, within reason, within that optimal zone. You want them to be stressed in all different sorts of ways. You want yourself to be stressed in those different ways. And that will optimize your response. You don't want too little. You don't want too much. It takes a lot of wisdom to figure out what is. And that's also when you have graduate students in school, you're stressing them. You're definitely stressing them. And you have to figure out, you don't want them to have a nervous breakdown. You don't want yourself to have a nervous breakdown. You want people to be challenged. You might call it stressed. But you don't want it to be, you don't want it to be too little. You don't want it to be too much. You want to, and that takes on the human interaction side, that takes a lot of wisdom, to know. And that's what coaches do. I mean, that's what coaches do. They are stressing their swimmers or their runners or their players. But you have to understand the psychology of a coach is really to optimize performance, and you're optimizing performance within that hormetic zone. So and this is not and really much different than you know, what's the optimal length for a cold shower, what's the optimal length for a sauna, how hot, how this and how that. It all has its quantitative parameters, all centered around framing a hormetic dose response.
Yeah, it's like the hormesis has, you know, health benefits to you, but like resilience is also like a virtue in terms of, let's say, your role as a human being, or not another role, but, you know, as a part of a society. Like if you're more resilient, both physically and mentally, then you're like, you know, more reliable as a member of the society, and you're more like functional as well in many ways. So like, yeah, I think many people would need to be, or the, you know, a lot of the modern society makes us less resilient or makes us more fragile in many ways. You know, first of all, most people don't exercise and they don't do anything physical, but also mentally, like there's this, I guess, yeah, like everything is kind of like safe and everything is very predictable in some ways, and you don't lack this mental, let's say, challenge that much, or like you're not required to have like a lot of mental resilience, if that makes sense.
No, it fits right into the same framework that we're talking exactly, and it's an all-encompassing concept, because it's from psychology, sociology, all the way down to the individual cell, and it's all coping with stress, actually, and try to optimize your response to your environment. I mean, this is it's really very interesting how it all works. But yes,
well, it's been great talking with you. We could definitely do many hours more of all the details and all the different types of stress. But before I ask my last question, where can people learn more about you and your work?
If you're a scientist, you can certainly find me in PubMed and Web of Science, because I publish a lot and publish, there. But I'm at the University of Massachusetts, and anybody who wanted to email me, you can post my email. It's edwardc@umass.edu. I answer emails quickly, and I'd be happy to talk to people on the phone. And you can post my telephone number as well, and I think that's and I'd be I'm open to talk to people on Zooms. It's fun to talk and see who you're talking with, and if you're interested in what we have and we have a professional interest, that would be great. So I like to communicate with people.
Sounds good. And my last question is, what's this one piece of advice or a habit that you wish you adopted sooner?
One piece of advice that I would offer?
No, that you wish you adopted sooner.
Oh, one thing that I would, well, that's interesting. Well, I would have to say that I would have to say that I would it would be tied into intermittent fasting. Wish that I had done that much earlier. Exercise I've done from a young age, so I've ever since I was, you know, 5 years old, I haven't stopped moving since, you know, exercising since. So I think it'd be more on a dietary basis than anything else. So I leave it that way.
Gotcha. That's good. I've been also doing a lot of, or I've been doing intermittent fasting since I was like 18 or something. So over 10 years.
Well, then that's the way. You've got a good start on it. Wonderful start on it. Thank you so much for having me on this, and I appreciate it.
Yeah, and looking forward to your future studies and papers.
Thank you very much. And there's always something new coming out, published quite a bit every year.
But do you want to achieve and maintain biological youth? If yes, then I'm looking for more people who want to add healthy years to their life. If you're interested, then email me the word health to info@siebenlund.com and I'll send you the details.